Hi, Bobby here. So this week we are putting out a re-release from our archive. I know that last week we were talking about coming into a new era of the podcast, and that remains true. However, we did just have two guests reschedule quite last minute, so our next new episode will have to be next week. But we're working on it. We have loads of brilliant guests on the way. And in the meantime, please enjoy this favourite from our archive. Yeah, that's all right, isn't
yeah.
it? That's all I need to say.
Yeah.
Cool.
This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatise mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about identity. So how we identify, how we see ourselves, and how that can relate to our mental health. It's quite a nuanced but fascinating topic, one that comes up in bits during other episodes, and we wanted to devote a whole episode to it, and we have possibly the best guest to do that with. Before we talk about them, though, I've got two stats to start us off. This isn't really something there are statistics for. What identity means to you could be so different for every person. But in particular, I wanted to look at two stats in reference to what it means to have mental health issues, how that factors into our identity. So one we'll often hear is that one in four people will experience a mental health problem each year in England. That one is from Mind, and the reason I wanted to bring it up is because it's often misquoted. So often you hear about the one in four, and you don't hear that will experience a mental health problem each year. And that bit's really key because it can, I think, actually lead some people to think prevalence is a bit less, or that there's this idea of one in four people and they're this other group that has mental health problems and the rest of people don't. But actually, no, that's just in any given year. It's a quarter of people. It may not be the same quarter next year, although obviously there'd be crossover.
Absolutely. It's such a good point to raise. That is really just highlight the prevalence on a big scale.
So you know how I am about things being misquoted. It really frustrates me. And that's one that you hear all the time. And then an additional one also from Mind you hear a lot less is that one in six people report experiencing a common mental health problem in any given week in England. So when you drill down to a week, it's one in six, which of course is less, but again, can be different people each week. And the fact that they even have a stat like that, I think really speaks to the nature of what it is to be the four in four. That stats like these are really brilliant for prevalence, but that is dangerous from an identity point of view of then separating people off or thinking about what it means to be someone that's affected by mental health versus someone that's not. And of course, we all are. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on what it is to both be part of the one in four and also part of the four in four. Because I think we try and really tackle both on the show. You know, obviously we have our specialism, but the issues that come up can affect everyone. And that's a big part of why the stigma is so important to erase.
Yeah, I was just about to say that it just does affect everyone. And I was speaking to somebody the other day who is a practitioner actually, and said, you know, this whole one in four stat really frustrates me. When I then explained the rest of the statistic that's often missed out, she was like, oh my God, I didn't even think about it like that. I just thought the one in four wasn't accurate because it happens to everybody. We're all struggling at different times and experiencing different levels of mental health. And so even she was surprised by that. And that then surprised me that this woman I'm talking to was like really dismissive. So even though it wasn't in a bad way, because she was like, you know, she was trying to bring more light to it, you know, she'd still not thought about the fact that we're talking like, you know, per year.
Yeah, it's massive. And that's the point, right, that so much of this can be conditional. There are certain times when, of course, we are under more pressure in terms of our mental health, and that can be an issue in and of itself. But then there's other times when the issue goes beyond the situation. You know, having a stressful week at work, you're stressed. If things then calm down again and you're still feeling certain symptoms of stress, then that's when maybe there could be something more to it. And for a lot of people, it takes an event that's particularly severe to highlight issues that were already there. You know, that was certainly my experience, that it took my mental health getting bad to a certain point to then address a lot of what had been going on anyway.
Absolutely. And then the fear is that people attach that experience to their identity, and other people attach those experiences to their identity. And it becomes something that is spoken about quite upfront when we meet people, like, is gender, or obviously race is not, because we can see, well, we think we see what we think people are. And again, try and attach an identity to, he's got white skin, so we're in England, he's probably British. We know that doesn't go, that doesn't work either. But we attach, don't we, different things to then build somebody's identity. We do it to ourselves and others do it to us, and, you know, we do it to others. That's the danger.
Yeah, and the danger of the stigma. Because you then go in with certain assumptions. If you know someone's struggling with their mental health and you have stigmatizing attitudes towards that, then you may think that affects their competence or whether or not you'd want to spend time with them, or, you know, if you think they'll be reliable. That's one I used to get a lot, actually, people thinking, oh, you've got depression, you're probably always late for things. And I'm like, that's actually not accurate at all, but it's, you know, these kind of stereotypes that could come up. But then equally, that I guess can be positive ways of looking at it as well, where there isn't stigma. So actually, somebody checking in on my mental health who knows me well is actually really nice, and is an acknowledgement when someone's like, oh, how's your mental health at the moment, when they specifically ask and go beyond that. Oh, how are you? Fine. How are you? Fine. So that when it's done right, and when people consider mental health of others appropriately, then it can be a part of your identity that can feel really validated. And that's certainly the way that I've come to look at it, which it's not for everyone. But for me, I'm a big believer in finding a place for your mental health struggles in who you are. I think the idea of it being something that happens to you can be quite dangerous and also quite disempowering, that maybe we would then be inclined to hope that it passes or try and shake it off, whereas actually it often doesn't work that way. And so for me, finding where my depression and my eating disorder fit within my life is a way to deal with them, because then I look out for the symptoms, I keep on top of it with self-care and other practices to keep myself well. And so that's a way for it to be part of who I am, but not in a way that I feel is to my detriment, that actually it's me coping better because I acknowledge it. And then by doing so, people find a lot of power in that, and it breaks the stereotypes. Because when I'm well, I'm not talking about, oh, I used to have depression, because I know it's still in there and I go up and down. And that's obviously it varies for everyone, but for me, these things come and go. And so by acknowledging that, being honest about it, then I think it's its own way of breaking the stereotypes, because people can see that I have good days and bad days. And that's a far bigger factor in reliability than the binary of, do you have mental illness or do you not? Which we know it's a spectrum anyway.
Yeah, what a beautiful way to talk about it.
I'm glad I've explained it well.
Yeah, you have. I think that's absolutely right. And as we have often said so many times on our show, we believe it's a superpower anyway, you know, when we've dealt with those who do experience poor mental health, depending how you build it into who you are, can really like elevate you, I think, can really make it, because so many people do, when you are open and can share and your family are, and friends are supportive and they're not hiding it and it's not a secret, and we embrace everybody's health, whether it's physical or mental, and whether it's great or not so good, then we allow people to thrive in that, you know, as well, rather than it be a secret and then I just stay in and I'm quiet because I'm going through a bit of a, you know, bad time at the moment, you know, and we're not waiting for them to get better all the time, like that whole recovery thing. That's another episode, but yeah.
Right. No, it's true. And I guess the stigmatizing side of that could be people saying, oh, you're making it a part of your identity. You know, you're making it a part of who you are. And actually, it's like, no, this is the reality. This is what I'm living with. Of course, there are many people where they have mental health struggles that are more situational. Postnatal depression is often an example where actually part of the child growing up can be part of the solution. Like, that doesn't mean you shouldn't get support, but there can be a certain aging off of that particular struggle for some people. And so I could see that being something that people very much talk about in hindsight. But for many people, these things do come and go. And we're always a bit wary of that, actually, when we have guests pitch us who are very focused on talking about everything in the past. Sometimes we get emails like, oh, I've got the fix for PTSD. And then we look at them and they're not a PTSD counselor or anything. It's, you know, we start to get a bit nervous about what they mean by that. And sometimes it can be a stigmatizing attitude that they're like, I pushed it all down, I put it away, and now I'm fine. And you're sort of like, I don't know if that's how it works necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, that's not me trying to be judgmental, but I think I've certainly seen personally enough examples of where people have tried to brush it off and pretend that something's in the past. And sometimes the more you say that, the less I believe you.
Yeah.
And so instead, I'm a real advocate for if it's an ongoing issue for you, own it. Find a place for it in your life because it's already there.
Absolutely. And to be honest, Bobby, I might sound a bit naive here and you might have had different experiences, but I haven't come across anyone in all my years of work and life who has said to me, I went through this and now, and that was then and now, there's just never anything anymore. Like that door's closed and now the last 20 years I've been riding high. I've just never met, you know, so I'm the same when I hear either through documentaries or podcasts or different people talking about that was an episode. Like I understand with psychosis being one of them that you can have a psychotic episode and there be an end to that episode.
Mm.
But those people generally still talk about having their mental health go up and down throughout their lives, and then they may have another episode or never another one. Some people have them at 8, that might have an episode at 18, somebody else talking to through recreational drugs, and then went on to have a psychotic episode and has never had one since, and they're now 35, but clearly speak openly about depression and different, you know, struggles that they have with their mental health. So it's a real interesting one. There may be people out there that disagree with me and say, Danielle, look, I know that you know, ill and be struggling with their mental health and then be absolutely fine forevermore. And that's amazing, of course, but I've just not really experienced that.
I know what you mean. I know there are people out there like that, and I've definitely had messages and stuff like that, and not everyone appreciates that I'm so comfortable in owning certain issues I still have around me as part of who I am. But it's part of what gives me insight in a show like this. You know, I am a big believer in the work never stops. So yes, there absolutely are situations where people have quite a linear recovery, can talk about things in a past tense. Mm-hmm. I think the danger of being too strict on that is you can then miss out the things that you've learned and the general good mental health practices to continue. So just because things have changed for you doesn't mean self-care is no longer important.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you shouldn't still check in with how you're feeling. Doesn't mean you'll never experience a difficult period again. And so there's a lot of sort of maintenance stuff we can do to all look out for each other, to be more honest about how we're feeling, to not push our emotions down, to not, you know, expect more of ourselves than we can meet on certain days. You know, all of this stuff is just general good life practice, you know, irrespective. And that's why I do like the 1 in 4, as you say, for prevalence. But I think we try and also talk about what's relevant to the 4 in 4, what we can all take. We have it time and time again. We speak to a guest who has a very different experience to us, and we find all these parallels. We go into it thinking, oh, I don't know much about this condition, or, you know, this person has a very different background to me. I wonder if I'll be able to relate. And we find that you always can.
Mm.
It's being human.
Absolutely.
We have the same emotions. It's just how much are you feeling them? How much are they affecting you? What symptoms do you have?
And the freedom to talk about that and be open about that is so empowering. Just like with our, you know, our episode today on identity, they go hand in hand. And, you know, I feel so strongly about the fluidity of identity or what identity actually means and how deep that can go and the impact that can have then on our mental health when you're stuck in your mind in terms of what your identity should represent or is to you or is to other people.
Because as difficult as it can be to have certain labels on your mental health, they can also be really empowering. You know, that was my experience getting my depression diagnosis first and realizing, oh, there is an answer here. And I often talk about similar things on the show with, like, my dyslexia, for example. Finding out that I had dyslexia was finding out that I wasn't stupid.
Yeah.
Because that's what I thought. And so I'd take the dyslexia label any day over feeling stupid. And, you know, all the things that does for your self-esteem, your self-belief, your identity generally, to know, okay, this is something tangible that I can work at. It is part of who I am, but there's things I can do about it. And that's maybe part of why I approach mental health in a similar way. And it's interesting with today's guest, that similar thing. You know, they are very open about a lot of elements of their life, elements of all sorts, like their sex life, like their music comes into their work. A lot of their past academically informs work that they do today, even if it's very different. Yeah, an incredible artist to talk all about identity. So it's Cheddar Gorgeous, who is a drag queen, anthropologist and TEDx speaker, and someone that we are personally a fan of. We're so delighted to get to chat to. And I'd really recommend, once you've listened to the interview, do give Cheddar a Google, because I think you'll be wowed by how that, you know, not just their artistry, but also how they put themselves across in it and how kind of lived in the way they identify and present to the world feels. And that's something that I aspire to. You know, we're doing ads at the moment for Stitch Fix, and we got chatting about how you put your identity in what you wear. And I think there's a space for that with everything, including mental health. We found such power in identifying with things we've been through, and that's what people really connect with.
Absolutely.
I think it's very difficult to connect with a, everything's fine, never had any issues, I can't relate to those people. I don't believe they exist.
I'm exactly the same. And I think, you know, on the whole, in summary, if you like, I believe that identity is of the soul. I really do. And all of the stuff we talk about, you know, clothes and fashion and all the things that we like that are all outside things, which are all great, but none of it is our identity. All of that stuff's just nice to have things, and we enjoy all of that. And, you know, again, when you listen to the interview, and I think that's great advice, Bob, actually go and Google Cheddar, because you will be surprised. I was surprised. The artistry, for one, is amazing, like absolutely amazing. And then speaking to Cheddar is just on a different level. And then listening to Cheddar on the TED Talk is, again, something new. And I think that that is why, you know, they are an amazing guest to talk, you know, about identity, because it really is about what's in the soul, and that you can switch and be where you want to be and who you want to be. And no one can tell you shit about that. Keep it in you, keep it with you, and you'll be all right, I say. We actually could speak about identity all day, Bob, because we haven't even touched on the racism aspect of it. Me being mixed race, you know, that's a whole other element with identity. Race, huge. Sexuality, massive. Gender.
And you reminded me of something about Cheddar, actually. If you Google them, it says, Cheddar believes that life is too short to only be one person.
Wow.
And I think that's really fun, because you're right, it's a reflection. All of the stuff you see on the outside is a reflection of what's going on internally. Mm-hmm. People can tell that I'm confident before they meet me, and seeing pictures of Cheddar, you can tell the same. But that's something you have to work on. I don't come across like that when I'm struggling with my mental health at the worst. And so we're so delighted to explore identity with Cheddar Gorgeous. We'll get into that interview in a moment, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hello, it's me, Cheddar Gorgeous. And I do have another name that I go by, which is Michael Atkins. And I feel, in the spirit of the podcast, I should be acknowledging that other, more mundane, more everyday version of myself, because I think some of the issues we're going to be talking about, that other presentation of me. It may come as a shock for many of the listeners to know that I began my life in Birmingham in the Midlands, and being a boy raised in the Midlands, talking about your mental health and your feelings or anything in general, often wasn't on the anything in general about your welfare wasn't always on the agenda. And more than that, my mum, who is a very wonderful, wonderful woman who I adore, she was a nurse when we were growing up, and a very, I think it's fair to say, a very, very practical woman, a very skilled woman, but a very, you know, that kind of stalwart, practical, working class mom. And I think sometimes in those settings, the idea of your emotional well-being or your ability to communicate and having a dialogue about things just wasn't really on the agenda. And so I think I was raised really with this idea that mental health problems, because my mum, ironically, was a mental health nurse, but mental health and issues with mental health was a problem that other people had. And I think that was because we were a very pragmatic family, and my mum was a very pragmatic woman. I don't think, and you can, I think you can probably tell already, she was a dominant character in my life, and I'm very glad for it. But it was certainly something that we didn't take ownership of for ourselves, not until much later in my life.
Right. And I think that can be a really common outlook of nurses, that kind of inherent sturdiness, maybe by the expectations in the NHS of how hard they should work. Do you feel that that kind of mentality was then expected of you as well?
The helper mentality, you know what I mean? That helper mentality. And I think I trained and I had an aspiration from a very early age to be a social worker. And that was the way that I was going to help. That was the contribution I was going to make to the world. And I think often for those people who see themselves as the helper, it's a wonderful and amazing thing. And I got so much from my upbringing, and I got so much strength from my upbringing. But the inverse of that is the denial of when you need help. And I think sometimes that's a survival tactic when you're a helper, because you have to deal with a lot of stuff. You have to be there for a lot of other people's problems. And so there comes a kind of cutoff to those things within yourself. Because like you say, that acknowledgement of weakness could affect your capacity to help. And obviously the thing that I think most helpers go through is they at some point realize that they have to acknowledge that aspect of themselves that requires support from others. Otherwise they burn out, they collapse.
100%. And as is the case with this kind of mentality, it doesn't save you from experiencing mental ill health. So when did those challenges come in for you?
It's funny because I think the denial of that stuff ends up creating its own little ruptures that then escalate, right? So thinking about the way that needing care, needing love, needing attention, how that became associated with something A, that I didn't need, and when I had those feelings, with something that I should feel guilty or ashamed about. And I think those little ruptures that you push down, they build up over a longer period of time into, for me at least, they became like patterns of self-testing. They became a desire for me to put myself through the mill. They became such that I would throw myself into situations where I was helping more or doing more extreme things or proving that I could cope, putting myself in situations that would be stressful and difficult to handle in order to show that I had that strength. And of course, when that comes hand in hand with the denial that you need support from those situations, eventually you just end up with something that ends up crackling and cracking and becoming knotted and static. Do you know what I mean? Staticky. And so for me, that really started to manifest before exploding and finding my love in the world of drag. I was a researcher and doing quite difficult research. And research, to be honest with you, that I feel now, when I look back in hindsight, I needed more support with, support that I didn't seek. And as a result, I became very anxious. I became very paranoid. There were points in my life where I was worried about, the research was very muddled up with people who probably aren't that nice, at least some people who aren't that nice. And so I became very paranoid about certain relationships, about certain connections. I was scared to leave my house at one point. So I went through quite a bad rupture to my self-confidence, to my sense of who I was, to my sense of the person who could cope with anything. You know what I mean?
For sure. And do you think that lacking in self-confidence was also part of how you got into these situations, that this trying to prove something was also proving to yourself and everyone else a sense of worth?
Yeah, totally. That feeling that I should be able to cope with anything made me throw myself into those places where I would require support.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I needed to do it without the support in order to prove my own strength.
Yeah. And without that support, how did things escalate in terms of your mental health?
Well, that ended in a lot of therapy after that, which I had to see because I wasn't able to leave the house on certain days. It was later, actually. So I went through a period of recovery, and then I had a triggering event. Maybe like 2 years later, I had this kind of weird triggering event, which just sent me into a spiral of real negative thinking. And weird feelings of shame and responsibility and guilt. And as a result, ended up being in therapy for like 3 years, maybe. Something like that. Functionally, I was still living a life. I was still holding down a job. I was finishing my PhD, but it resulted in me needing to address that. And from that, kind of unearthing that need for care that I think I'd probably had for years and years and years that I'd been ignoring and denying, which is why I brought up my mundane name, mm-hmm. you know, because I think sometimes drag becomes a distraction further from that. It's ironic because that thing that I was unearthing, that need for care, that need for love, obviously drag became a real way that I could do that. You know, drag became a way that I could seek some of that love, some of that regard, some of that attention. Although at the same time, you have to be cautious with it because the kind of love, care and attention that you get from being a big spectacle in that way often ignores maybe some of the everyday, more mundane love that we all crave in our lives.
Mm-hmm. And I think it could have, for you, also extended this idea that you need to do something to be acceptable. You know, that's still not love for you just existing.
Totally. And I suppose I'm probably jumping a few steps ahead here in talking about this before I talk about how I got into drag. But I almost equate drag sometimes to a kind of candy. You know what I mean? It's like something that you crave, that kind of love, that kind of attention that we all maybe you're seeking a little bit more nowadays on social media, that kind of affirmation of who we are. It's incredibly saccharine. It's very addictive. You want more and more and more and more, but it never really fills you up. And so for me, as kind of I've done drag now for a decade, I'm finally getting to that point where I can recognize that's a wonderful thing and a great way of building confidence. But at the same time, it's not enough to fill me up. And it's not going to be enough to necessarily make you feel happy and feel centered at the end of the day.
We might come back to that a little bit more. To go back a little bit, when you were going through the 3 years of therapy, how was your attitude and your sense of self at that point?
I had gone from being an incredibly confident person, from being a person who was I was dandy, I was loud, I was a person who always kind of projected my sense of self into the world. I was really confident. And I went to a person who was very shy and who was literally scared. You know, I was scared to go out. I didn't want to engage with people socially. I didn't want to make friends. I was pretty fractured at that point. That feeling of being something that is irreparably damaged. And one of the things, when you're thinking about anxiety and depression, one of the things that I think is the most horrific thing about it is that when you are in that place, there is no concept that you can feel differently. And I think that's one of the saddest things and one of the most difficult things for people who haven't necessarily had that experience. Because from the outside, you go, come on, pull yourselves together. Feelings will pass. Things can change. You can rebuild. You can do different things. When you're in that place, the sense of hopelessness can be total. And you cannot see that there is another way of thinking. You cannot imagine a version of yourself that does not feel that way. And you cannot remember a version of yourself that didn't feel this way. You are caught up in that tangle and in that moment. And it's only through help and through seeking help that I came to a place where I could tell myself, I know this feeling passes. So when I would have an incident where I'd have negative thinking and couldn't get out of it, I've now got into a place where I can now go, I know that this will pass. I know that this will pass, even though it feels like it won't. And I'm a big fan of therapy. Of course, it's just so hard to get in the UK. I was lucky I had a job. I was able to pay for it myself. But I think you can, if you can get good therapy, then it does help you to have that level of perspective to be able to go, this is something that can be temporary and I can work through it and I can change.
Yeah. The way you've articulated that is so clear. It's something that I can really relate to with my experience of depression, that at one point it was so bad that the me I was when I was better started to feel like a myth, that I no longer recognized a version of myself. And one of the things that can be so difficult and complicated about this is, to some extent, it's true that there were many photos of me where I was smiling on purpose and pretending to be happy. And there were, you know, whole experiences people had with me where they thought I was fine and I wasn't. And so actually, the previous version of me wasn't even true, but that also didn't mean that was a myth. And through my own recovery and learning to understand my emotions better, I found a bridge between the two where I can be more honest, although sometimes that means I'm honest about struggling, and that's okay too.
This is really interesting. I never had a problem in articulation. You know, I trained as a social worker. You train in those kind of fields, see yourself in that kind of helping role. And I had a language to describe what I thought what I was going through. What I discovered through therapy was where I had a real problem was feeling. And that was linked to that feeling of guilt for having a need. And so what would happen with me, and discovered it through experiencing it during therapy, when I started to feel a strong emotion, everything shut down. One of the things therapy taught me was there are certain things about me that probably won't ever change, but it's nice to have the ability to think there might be a change at some point. But like, and one of the things about me is that I do struggle to feel, because my defense mechanism, my shutdown, says that feeling is something that I'm not allowed to do. Feeling is something that is for other people because it's a weakness. And as a result, I very effectively go from starting to feel an emotion to feeling nothing, which is incredibly useful in a crisis situation. And it's incredible, and incredibly useful as well when you're a helping person, when you want to help other people, because it means you can stand back and have that perspective and an ability to articulate and describe. But it can be a bit rubbish when what you want to feel is sad, or when you want to process a bit of sadness, or you know, when you want to feel anger. Anger is something that I'm developing in my late 30s. I'm learning to allow myself to be angry at things. And it was never allowed to be angry at things before. And like any reasonable adult, I'm taking that to Twitter, because that's the place where we get angry, isn't it? Check out my Twitter for Angry Cheddar. And also asking Boris Johnson when I can have a shag next.
It's so true. But you're right. You've distracted me slightly with your humour, which I wonder if that in itself could be defence as well.
Oh, yes.
But you're right, it is such an issue for a lot of people. And actually, in many ways, there's a big parallel with anxiety there. That in many ways, anxiety is great and very adaptive for crisis situations. But when it's constant, then it's ruining your life. And similar with that kind of defense mechanism, like shutting down. If your mum, for example, and she's dealing with a very traumatic situation and all her emotional focus needs to be on her patient, but the rest of the time, she has to also think of herself. And to a degree, she has to think of herself in that situation as well, and her own safety.
And if you're listening, Mum, that's the message I want you to take on board.
Look after yourself as well. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because she's worth it. She's wonderful, my mother.
No doubt. And she produced you, so it's a good sign. So coming back to your mental health experiences then. So we've talked a bit about the kind of paranoia that built up through a lot of your research, not getting adequate support. In terms of your attitude towards yourself at this point, am I right in thinking there was also issues with body dysmorphia around the same time as well?
I'm really glad you brought it up, because what's interesting, and I don't know, right? I don't know whether it's just because I've got a very bad memory. I had a brain disease when I was 18. I had meningococcal something or other. Meningococcal septicemia. Yeah, all of that. And I don't know whether it's my bad memory linked to that, having that brain disease, or whether there is something in the way that I exclude those experiences even now from discussion. You know, I'm very good at blocking out the stuff. And I always feel like these conversations are always like a therapeutic self-discovery. And so where I get to dissect the presentations I'm giving to other people and what I am concealing subconsciously in those conversations. And body dysmorphia is absolutely something that I know I have experienced from being a teenager. You know, I was a slightly chubby teenager. It's funny because I look back and I think of myself as like a big teenager. I think of myself as being quite overweight. And then when I see photos, I go, oh, I wasn't that overweight. I just had this sense of myself of being very overweight. And that is something that has followed me throughout my teen years, through my university years and into my adult life. And it's one of those things that probably is never going to change about me. I probably will never have a particularly rosy outlook on how I look, which is funny because I'm very into fitness to the extent where that in itself has on occasion become a problem for me in the level that I work out, certainly in the last few years as I've got a little bit older. But I struggle with seeing myself, I think, how other people see me. Which is strange. And I know you go, but Cheddar, you take your clothes off all the time, which I do. I do a lot of burlesque performance where I glitz up myself. So I'm not completely delusional. I understand how my body can be perceived in a positive light. But on a feeling level, even now, I'll catch myself in the mirror and think, you need to lose a bit there, or, you know, you're not what you were. And those kind of thoughts have been with me since I was young. And I remember when I was a school child throwing lunches away. I remember an entire period of my life right before I had the brain disease, actually, probably contributed to it because it was an immuno-based thing, isn't it, meningitis? But I remember not eating. I remember drastically losing weight very quickly around the age of 16, 17, just after I left high school. I don't think I ever got to the point of not eating at all, but I remember massively reducing my eating. But it's funny because it's still something that's very blocked to me, still something that I find it hard to think about. And then I had a string of illnesses, and then I was super unwell with meningitis, and I was in hospital for 2 weeks. I really lost a lot of weight then. But even coming out of that, I've always had this perception of my body as something that was really soft, like a Pillsbury Doughboy. Do you know what I mean? If I really confront my negative thinking about my own body, which is dead funny now because I lift weights, you know, I'm just got into high intensity interval training, like in a big way, and I'm like dead good at it, and I feel really proud about it. But there's still this weird lingering feeling that there's a softness to me that I'll never address, and that makes me ugly, and that makes me undesirable. And it means I'll never, ever be happy. And I can laugh about it. You know, laughing is my defense, and laughing is also my coping strategy. You might look at that as a kind of defensive thing, as something that's me avoiding the issue. But laughter and comedy as a way of connecting has also come to be my way of finding peace with some of the things about my particular patterns of thought that may not change. So yeah, I'm cool with making a joke out of my issues.
And I think that's very common and actually makes so much sense because it's also a way that you can keep these things in the conversation, but also be inclusive. So certain things we're talking about now, not everyone might want to hear in certain situations. It might be too intense for them. But if you can insert the jokes, it's a way to like broaden out the audience and make sure people feel comfortable at the same time.
Taking power over it too, though, isn't it, right? So you take power over in two senses. So you take power over literally almost on that primary voice of going, well, if I take the piss out of myself for this, then nobody else can take the piss out of me for it. So there's that. But also there's taking power over ridiculing the nonsense that I'm engaging because it doesn't really matter, you know? And actually the way I look, my perceived softness doesn't really matter. It's not actually important. And it's something that I need to treat more as a little funny thing about something that I do. And I'm not denigrating the importance of looking after my own mental health. I'm saying that that is part of my strategy of self-care and ensuring that I look after my mental health by reassuring myself that the thing that I'm worried about itself doesn't even matter. let alone the false process of worry that I'm engaged in.
Yeah, I really
love
that.
Very good self-analysis. Warned you about that.
No, I love it.
Hated me.
What, did you come into therapy with all these theories?
Oh, my God. And I remember because of I've got a very good friend of mine, Duncan Craig. He runs a charity called Survivors Manchester. And I said, Duncan, I went and saw him because I have such respect for him. And he's been such a caring friend and somebody who's so knowledgeable. And I said, Dunk, I need a therapist. But I need a therapist that isn't going to take my shit. That's because I knew that I would go in there with a strategy of avoidance. And I did. I had a really wonderful therapist who did not take my shit. And in a very loving way, in a very caring way, allowed me to see myself in a different way.
I think that's so important. And that's something I've definitely found through podcasting, that often it takes an outside person or platform or audience even to highlight the areas of omission you're engaging in. You know, I didn't realize how much I was avoiding talking about mental health until it was part of my work. And now I talk about it all the time and I have given myself that permission that I always feel it's appropriate because my platform is that mental health is always an appropriate topic. It should never be off the table. It is never irrelevant. It is always important. And I think one parallel I see in your work is that you found a way to give so much of who you are permission to exist and be okay and actually be incredible or fabulous, as you would say. You've given yourself that permission through drag.
It's strange because I talk about drag as this kind of revelation of self, and that is how I've come to see it. But when I first started doing drag, it was very much for me a disguise. At the time, I was quite paranoid. I didn't find it easy to leave the house. I was very unconfident. And drag became a way that I could pull back to those experiences I had of being flamboyant and confident. And almost kind of create a safe space to let that come back out. And in fact, let it grow into something new and to find a different kind of light. It became a way of literally shining a spotlight on my sense of self, my desire, my need to be seen. I think that's probably a better way to articulate it. It became a way for me to create a safe space for that need I had to be seen and to be heard, the thing that had been pushed down, that had not been recognised, my need in my belly become this incredible, uncontrollable, on occasion desperate need for affirmation and attention. And drag was certainly bound up a little bit with that, but it created a safe space where I could seek that and rediscover confidence and rediscover being seen and being looked at. And I think one of the really amazing things about drag is if you allow it to filter into your everyday life in a much more chill way, shall we say, in a way that doesn't need to be the only thing that's seen in a room. Because I describe that drag I think of as taking the thing that you feel that nobody recognizes about you and making it the only thing that they see. But alongside that, it seeps, which isn't a pleasant word to use in relation to self-confidence, but it sort of seeps into your everyday life. And you day by day realize that if you are worthy of being listened to in this big, extravagant way, and also if you can go out and look like that and be that radically different and that crazy and out there and not be denigrated, in fact, actually you can be celebrated for being that crazy and out there, it makes you feel a lot less afraid about showing the aspects of yourself in your everyday life that might be a little bit different or you fear might be rejected, because it doesn't matter anymore. If I can go out and do that, then I can probably speak my mind on that issue with that group of people, or I can probably stand up myself in that work situation, or I can probably deal with the awkwardness of a romantic liaison gone wrong, you know. So it allows you the perspective to think, if I can do that, then I can probably do most things in my regular everyday life, if you can keep that little drag monster in check, because she is thirsty as well.
I love that word, thirsty. And that's something I loved about your TED talk as well,
that Danielle and I both really love, that you talked about that relevance of drag to everyone, that we can mistake the drama of it and the extremeness of the drag presentation as something that is only relevant to a small handful of people. But actually, as drag has become more mainstream and more seen through particularly television, people are seeing parts of themselves in this. You know, these people that in many ways were kind of held up as this almost like mystical beings. And I feel like that includes through pantomime. It was like this sort of like strange person that was somehow beyond human. Yeah. Not only are they taller than all the actual women, but, you know, they're beyond human in the outfits and the volume and the tricks and all of these things. And actually, there's a lot that we can see through the vulnerability of putting yourself out there in such a big way. And there's ways in which drag challenges expectations that actually help all of us.
They're those outsiders and in-betweeners, I think, drag queens. And I equate them much more like shamans. And I use the term magic very intentionally. Like, and I'm not talking about crazy, spiritual, weird, you know, forces of electric lightning. I'm talking about social magic. I'm talking about how the magic of attention and holding attention and being something that is simultaneously part of a community and seen as separate from it, because it's so unusual and so different. And I think that's nothing new, but what's nice is it's an other that you don't fear. It's an other that you can love. Well, most people who see it in light entertainment don't fear drag queens. I know there are people out there for whom it's still quite a threatening and scary thing for somebody who kind of defies those boundaries of gender or the many other things that drag can be about. Because I don't think it's always only about gender. But yeah, I think it is a powerful thing. What I love, and I think we can apply this as well to thinking about people who have experience with mental health issues, and that is we so much want to look at others as people who are either to be, people who are either to be pitied or people who are either there to just entertain. And I think people look at drag queens in the same way, right? That you see often the pastiche of the tragedy or the pastiche of the clown. And what I really love about how people are embracing drag, and I think that we have a lot to learn about mental health from this, is that actually those people who are outside and who are other have a lot to teach you about yourself. And I think the same strength can be found for if you've experienced mental health problems. Because I guarantee you, if you have an understanding of your own mind that comes from having trouble with with your own mind, you have something to contribute and to teach somebody else about theirs. And it's one of the things that we did. We did a show called Drag SOS, which was one of the things that I really loved about it, was it's queer people, through the most part, working with people who don't identify as queer, and showing them that our outlandishness, our queerness, our thing that you consider to be strange or a weakness, we can show you something about your life. We can enhance your life, as we should embrace all of the diversity we encounter. It merely gives us a chance to reflect upon ourselves and think about how our lives might be better.
Watched episodes only last night and was in tears because it's so moving how, as dramatic as it may look, the drag transformations that you put participants through, it's really the changes on the inside that are what pull at the heartstrings. It's all the similarities you find, the ways in which you go into a household of someone you've never met and find, oh, my family dynamic is very similar to yours. And that's the real connection. That's really what stirs up the emotions and teaches people that there's such strength in honesty. And I love what you said about connecting with your emotions, because it's true. I can appreciate in hindsight how working with my own mental health to overcome certain issues has made me so much more connected to who I am, what my feelings are, and how I interact with the world.
It was unexpected for us on the show. It was...
Oh, really?
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, when I originally took the concept to the production company, and you go in with this grand idea, drag can change people's lives. It comes from conversations with me and my drag sisters and my drag family, and like, we really truly believe that drag changed our life, right? And that allows us to connect with something. to increase our own visibility to such an extent where we can help other people. We can do other, you know, it's superhero level stuff for us in our own mentality. So you go in there with this idea and kind of pitch it and like, yeah, definitely, drag can change people's lives, not really knowing whether it's just for you guys and it's not going to work on other people. But you think, whatever, it'll be a camp fun time anyway. We'll have a right laugh. You know what I mean? Putting random strangers in drag. And then obviously when you're there, it works. Like, it's crazy. And it works even more for people. I think the more conventional a life you perceive yourself as leading, the more incredibly profound drag will be for you. Because it breaks down all of those expectations. In drag, the only person you have to satisfy, you don't have to look beautiful, you don't have to do this, you don't have to do that. The only expectation people have of you is that you're going to defy their expectations. So you are free to truly explore something for yourself. It encourages a level of honesty. And I think if you look at, so one of the guys who worked with, Sean, was looking for a way to connect better with his son, his gay son, who did drag. He was a very kind of straight guy, played football, and it unleashed this torrent of honesty that he had to confront with himself about his feelings that he had failed his son growing up. He hadn't. He was a wonderful, loving, caring father and had more than made up for the expectations, I think, that he had on his child growing up. But it was that moment of honesty where they both could confront and reconcile that. And it took something as daft as, it's not daft, he was stunning, but it took something as daft as getting up on stage and miming to a song dressed up in a fabulous glitzy outfit made out of a curtain. But it took something that absurd to confront that issue, to bring something that up. And it's a bravery thing. If you can do that crazy stuff, then yes, you can absolutely talk to your son about whether he feels that you failed him as a child. You know, it's the extremes
right.
that can make that.
And that's the thing, isn't it? That if your identity has real weight and confidence behind it, then you can deviate from it. And that absolutely applies to masculinity as well. If you are that safe in your masculinity, then being put into drag will not change any of that, will not change who you are one bit, but you might discover a few things along the way.
If you're not comfortable, you'll know about it.
And so I really recommend people go and find that. It's on Channel 4, which used to be called 4OD. I think it's called All 4 now. So you won't have to wait long. Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. And so looking back on your experience through drag, through the support you've had with your mental health, I think a through line of a lot of this, learning who you are and how it is acceptable for you to be, how would you say your mental health is now and how hopefully has it improved?
I mean, I'm pretty good. I feel pretty good at the moment. I'm thinking a lot about social media. I'm thinking a lot about the forms of love and attention that we seek on social media at the moment. And I think for me, that's something that I'm addressing at the moment in my life, because especially when you're a person who's kind of semi-public eye, you know, I did stuff on the telly. It's very easy to get caught up with whether you are maintaining an interest of people, whether you're doing things that people want to see, whether you're succeeding, whether you're continuing to be the personality you expect of yourself to be. And so I'm thinking a lot about that at the moment and thinking about what it is that I need. And what it is that brings me pleasure and what it is that I want to do now in some respects. Because I feel like for me at the moment, my big issue mental health wise is I've become very hung up on other people's opinions. I mean, that's me being brutally honest with myself. And I think all of my best work has always come from a place where I didn't care what people thought. So I think it's going to be interesting over the next few years. I'm doing some interesting work. So hopefully that will help my mind to expand in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it. And that is honest. It's an ongoing process. I don't believe in this idea of being fixed when it comes to mental health. It's an ongoing process. And actually, there's such power in that, in constantly learning new skills to manage your mental health. You learn about yourself, you learn how to support other people. And I find that incredible. And I find that incredible about your work, this constant evolution
And that is something that I worry about with social media, including when it comes to drag queens, if you can get too stuck in what people expect of you. And that in itself, specifically with drag, feels very undrag. If you are expected to always present in the same way, then you've lost the challenge and the sort of shock value that's part of what makes this art form so fascinating.
Well, it funnels back to body dysmorphia as well for me. So it funnels back into, I worry sometimes standard people put out there in drag is all about beauty. And I think for me, drag absolutely is about finding a moment of beauty or even a moment of just being seen, because it can be being absurd. You know what I mean? I think there are plenty of drag queens who do very kind of crazy busted makeup that are incredibly valuable and wonderful as drag queens. But I think the risk is that you become too caught up with the fantasy you create. And I think one of the really special things about drag that makes it very different from other kinds of celebrity when it comes to the idea of those fantastical beauty standards we are all expected to adhere to, is that in drag, we know that you are in costume. You know, I'm not pretending to be another person, but I also know it's an extreme presentation of myself and it's not maintainable on every day. And you as an audience member know that too. You know that there is a version of me that takes the makeup off and it's okay for me to be that version. And I think there's a real secret there that we're not tapping into, because in that we learn the lesson that all of the BS that celebrities sell us all the time, that the perfect lives that they're leading, the perfect contouring that they always have, that is also a drag and they take that off. And we should feel okay with just being okay with how our faces look with no makeup on. I don't wear any makeup now when I'm not in drag. I don't, makeup for me is extreme experience. Dressing up is a spiritual, I wear trackies most of the time. And I like that level of relaxation. I like that level of self-acceptance.
And I think that's a really lovely way to wrap up then. Thank you. And if people want to find more of your work, and I'd really recommend they check out your Instagram at the very least, because whatever you think Cheddar in drag looks like, you will be probably surprised. Where should people find you online?
They can find me on my Instagram. I'm doing a bit more stuff on YouTube now. It's a bit longer form. And then if you want to see Angry Cheddar, definitely pop over to Twitter. Although I'm attempting to rein it in, because ultimately somebody else owns the argument and is exploiting my opinion somewhere along the way. I'm suspicious of it all. But yeah, I'm enjoying angry Cheddar on Twitter at the moment.
Grand. All right, we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry I talked so much.
You were brilliant.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.